introduction, and thanks for being here. We're really excited to talk today. And yeah, welcome to our talk, Beginner's Guide to the Security Galaxy. Let me shortly introduce ourselves again. I'm Fiona, I'm the defender. This is Linus, he's a hacker tonight. So from the preceding talks and from many news and blogs and articles, most of us know that our digital lifestyle is paved with hazards. And our goal tonight is to take away your fear of actually dealing with those issues and get you interested in the topic. So those hazards include, as Google Image Search tells us, hackers, evil hackers with sheen masks, but also governmental institutions that have reached a ridiculous amount of power by being able to spy on every one of us. And I personally, and I think a lot of people agree, think that there is no technical solution to the political dimension of this problem, but there are means and ways and tools to reduce the risk of being spied and to make this a huge issue before we finally have smashed capitalism, but that comes later. First, let's get to the tools that we can use. In the past years, I've been working a lot with different people that are totally beginners and that I've been trying to encourage to get into technology. And from those years and dealing with a lot of different people, I've learned some lessons that I think can be boiled down to three assumptions that I'm making about you. So first, I'm assuming that most of you already know what the weakest spots are. It's nothing new to you. You already know that having a password that's whose most important criteria is that you can remember it when you're drunk is maybe not the safest way to go, but you still have it. Secondly, I'm assuming that you've been doing this for quite a while. So you've been knowing it, but you haven't really changed anything about it because third, the entire discourse and discussion and also community and scenes around surveillance, Snowden, and so on can be at times very intimidating and quite sophisticated. So it seems all the time like everybody else is having super crazy security skills, but you don't, so you don't even dare talking about this. And I know totally how that feels. But don't worry, we are here tonight to respect that and take you by the hand on your first steps to more security. We do this with four simple steps. Since I get security, we have the solution in four steps. First, we'll get rid of some basic myth that have been circling around surveillance and security issues for a while. Then we'll introduce you to the most basic lessons to go that we think are most important. That would be password security and what open source technology is about. And then we introduce you to some more tools that we think are so-called low-hanging fruits that we think you should have heard of and that are easy to apply. And in the end, I'll give you some suggestions on how to continue after this talk, hopefully. So there's this one myth that I think is the most hardest to get over with. Digital security is hard and super complicated. Actually, it's not. In fact, I think the biggest challenge that we are facing is getting over our own fear that we are too stupid to handle digital security. And telling from my experience with people, I can tell that this is the biggest problem I am facing when I'm trying to teach them digital security tools. That they're always thinking that this is too hard, this is over-challenging, and they don't dare to go further. Sometimes, of course, it can be challenging if you are using new tools, but they are not more difficult than any other tool. And also, in fact, the tools are getting easier and safer to use. And the more people use them, the easier they will get. Same here. You don't have to be an expert to use those. There's no magical obstacle between you and actually and the ability to use digital security tools. You can learn them too. Like, I mean, if I can do it, you can do it too. And you can actually teach others and become an expert by simply daring to ask. And this one is a classic. I'm a super boring person. I have nothing to hide in front of anybody. If you think this applies to you, I strongly suggest to you that you take out your phone, you enter the PIN if you have one, and give it to whoever's sitting next to you, and open your messaging app. Or your colleague, or your boss, or your partner, or your mother. There's always something that you want to hide, unless you're really a super boring person. Otherwise, if you think that it will never get this personal with the German government, maybe it does for somebody else in your address book, because communication is never a one-way route. It always takes at least two people for communication. And consider this when you communicate and think about digital security tools and whether to use them or not. You always also have the responsibility to everybody in your address books. And just from telling that you're here, I can guarantee that each one of you has at least one activist, journalist, filmmaker, anarchist in the address book, and you're responsible for their security too. And in the end, when we're talking about the dimension of the NSA scandal or whatever, this is not about you sadly being spied on. This is about society, power, and the world you want to live in. So having clarified that, let's get to the basics. Password security. Imagine Linus, hacker, evil, is trying to attack us. Just for tonight. He doesn't do that usually, but tonight he is. And I'm the defender, so I'm telling us how to defend ourselves.
So yes, I guess the easiest way to get access to your communication. And what Fiona said in the beginning, we want to make it easy to defend yourselves, and it's not like digital security is a superpower that you need to apply, and the same is true for attacking other people's digital security. You don't have to be a particularly smart person. There are tools that help you to do it. And so I want to show it to you. So attackers are not going to spend more time on an attack than they need to. So if there's an easy way in, why would I take a more complicated one? So we figured, since usually when we speak, there are people that sit in the audience with laptops, we kind of realized that wouldn't be the case here. But who has no password protection on their phone, smartphone or iPhone? No password protection.
I'm not gonna say.
Very good. He's not going to say. All right. If you don't have any password protection, I guess there's not even an attack that applies to you, right? It's just you just take the phone and use it. Who has a password on their phone and has the same password someplace else? That's quite a lot, but not as many as I expected. Who has a Facebook password that's different from their email password? Whoa. That's really like the most professional audience here. I think I need to change that. Or you're lying and you figure that, you know, probably he's thinking something. Okay, so the attacker. Of course, the easiest way in for the attacker is you have a post-it next to your screen and it tells people your password. That's very easy, right? So the easiest way is knowing your password, right? The second easiest way, of course, is being able to guess your password. So, if you have a dog, chances are that's your password. If there's a subject that you keep talking about all the time, like, I don't know, a car, or something else, or a star. Marcus mentioned, what's the singer called that you mentioned? Taylor Swift. Maybe your password is Taylor Swift, if you like Taylor Swift, right? And if you take the big password breaches of the past and make a list of the most common passwords, you get something like password 123456789. That's when passwords were asked to be 8 characters long. 1234, very common on phones. 12345, to, you know, you think, well, that's smart. Nobody's gonna think I added a 5. They'll never know. Then there are some words, and you see that this is apparently a US audience here that was mainly hacked. So if I'm a random attacker, I would of course first use these names or these passwords. So don't use those, right? Don't use a common password that anybody else has. So we want a password to be one that nobody else has. That gets the attacker to the problem. You know, when we've ruled out we're not using our dog's name, we're not using one of the most common passwords, we're not using our own name, which many people do, so they have username and password are the same. Then finally the attacker has no options left but to guess And what the attacker does then is just use a dictionary of words and apply it to the path to your password prompt, or just start out with A, B, C, D, E, and then combine A, A, B, A, C, and just continue letter combinations, right? And you can do a couple of thousand guesses per second on the computer. And this results in a curve like this. So assuming you have an alphanumeric password, so that's letters, numbers, and special characters, and it's six characters long, it takes a couple of minutes to crack this password. If it's seven letters long, you get to the point of it costing almost 60 days. Never underestimate the power of exponential mathematics. So when you get to the point of having eight or nine characters, it becomes very, very hard for an attacker to crack your password in a reasonable time frame. So we want this password to be long enough and complicated enough so that the attacker cannot guess it, and the attacker cannot guess it by applying the power of random guessing to the power of exponential mathematics. So since I said I want to come back to the phone, if you think about this, you should not underestimate the attacker's creativity. So if you have a four-digit PIN code on your phone, I could apply a little Lego toy like this. This is a robot arm that just keeps trying all password combinations, right? And in this case, this is an interesting, so as a programmer, I find it very interesting because you can even optimize how long the arm takes to get from one number to the next, and you can optimize by how often certain number combinations are used, and usually this robot is done after just a few attempts because you have like this 2580. That looks random, right? But it's like just a straight line down in the telephone keypad. So we remember good passwords are long, random, unique, and consist of letters, digits, and special characters. But Fiona is much better at explaining than I am, so just to make sure you understand this, she's going to really explain it to you why you want this to be like that.
Exactly. Now that Linus has proved that he's a super evil and effective hacker, we should know how to protect ourselves against him. As he said, good passwords are long, because it just takes so much more time. I mean, don't underestimate the curve of exponential mathematics. With each additional digit, it takes so much more time for the robot or the hacker, the attacker, to crack your password. Oops. They are random, because if the attacker, Linus knows me fairly well, he might know that my password is Linus, and he might try it, because he knows me. So I'd rather have a random password, and I'd better not have a password that is in a dictionary, because that's pretty easy for a computer to just throw all the dictionaries of this planet in it, because they are there digitally. They are unique, so if he does crack one of my passwords, he's not able to crack my other accounts as well. That is super important, because then you're quickly out of the loop. If you lose the password for your email account, imagine what happens. If I would try this, because you know, many of us do forget our passwords, usually you reset them via your email account. So if you lose that one, you're out.
The most beautiful thing that can happen is, as a small anecdote, not that I was ever involved in anything like this. Imagine you hack a nice online shop, right? It's like a shoe online shop or something, and they didn't handle your password safely, and they just wrote it into their database. And you sign up with your email address and with the password that you're using everywhere, because it's just so convenient to use the same password everywhere, you don't need to remember a different one. Now the attacker has a list of email addresses and a list of passwords. Well, you can guess what the first thing is that the attacker is going to try. He's just going to use these passwords for these email addresses. And the success rate in cases like this is somewhere between 25 and 60% of just taking over all the people's or other people's email accounts just by hacking a stupid small online shop that you registered to last week to get the rubber boots for the rainy fusion here.
How does he know? However, and they also consist of letters, digits, and special characters, because that also increases the effort that the robot or the attacker has to invest to crack my password. So, how does that look? This, for example, is a fairly good password. This also is a fairly good password. This also is a really good password. So, what you should do in practice is get a really big journal and write down all the passwords, and you should have a different one for each one. Just kidding. Of course, there's a solution for this. You don't have to write them down because nobody can memorize those. And in fact, for this problem, where do I put down my passwords? Humankind has found a particular good solution for this. And when I heard about this, I actually thought, like, why didn't anybody tell me this? Like, years ago, I could have saved so much time on making up passwords, memorizing passwords, resetting passwords because I just lost them. And the answer is, you get a password manager. And it's so much easier. And actually, as I said before, some tools actually facilitate, yeah, I know, isn't it awesome? Some tools actually facilitate your digital experience. And the password manager that I use is KeePassX. It's for free, it's open source, you can download it for different operating systems. And it just works like this. It has a database that you access with one strong password that you should memorize. And it's a database where you just put in, it actually generates a password for you too, so you don't have to make up a super smart password. It just generates it, you put it in the database, and you make a descriptive name like Amazon or YouTube or whatever, or Facebook. You just go in, copy, and paste it into your browser. And it's super secure because the database itself, I could give you this database. It wouldn't be a problem because it's encrypted with a strong password. So this is the first step that you should do as soon as you go home and have recovered. Install a password manager. It makes life much easier. And the second basis will be described to you by Linus.
Yeah, so now that we have taken a first step to even secure our services and our tools and our machines at all by giving them secure passwords, we should start worrying about the aspects of mass surveillance, right? So, if I send an email to Fiona, for example, this email will go through my personal email server that is hosting my emails, then go through the internet somewhere, nobody knows where it's going, right? It's the internet, it's somewhere, we never see it, I think it's in the ground or somewhere, and arrive at her email server. And along the way, it's basically transported unencrypted. So every single server that is handling this email, in this case it's at least two, mine and hers, has absolute access to this email and can read it. If you're hosting your email with Google, you're using Gmail, Google can read all the contents of your email. And so can the NSA that tries to break Google's systems, as we have learned. If you're with web.de, imagine that. Web.de can read your emails. And so can the intelligence services that web.de collaborates with, or any attacker that takes over web.de's servers. So even if you think, oh wow, I'm with Posteo and now I'm very, very safe because they claim to not read my email, you never know. If any attacker opens it, they can read it. And if you're sending emails to somebody else that's using a less trustworthy email provider, your emails may still very, very well be read. So why not go ahead and try to abolish this whole idea of trusting somebody else? I just want to trust the person that I'm trying to communicate with and not the messenger to not open it. So the principle you should try to remember here is the principle of end-to-end encryption. This means that there is a separate layer of encryption between the sender and the recipient that makes sure that only the recipient can actually decrypt the message. So if you talk to any email provider, they will tell you, yes, yes, we use transport layer encryption. Very, very nice encrypted communication here. But this only means that they are encrypting the communication between one server and the other, and on each server, the email is there in plain text again. So as long as we don't have this encryption part really in our own hands, and as long as we're not making sure personally by a separate process that we encrypt, there just is no encryption. And this is, as Fiona said in the beginning, not only a problem for, you know, targeted espionage because we're trying to, I don't know, overthrow the government, sell drugs, or help refugees enter the country, or whatever is considered a problem and gives intelligence services and police probable cause to read our email. This is also a problem for us as a society, because we just give this large data piles that can be analyzed and that can be used not against us individually, but against society as a whole. So we want to make sure that only the intended partner can decrypt the messages. The classic principle, or the classic tool that you all know about, is PGP. Okay, you know about it? Okay, I was a bit afraid. Okay. So you know about it? So, but nobody really uses PGP, right? So we're trying to get to a couple of more tools. But now here's the interesting question. Who can tell me why PGP is considered secure and some other systems are not? There's a very strong principle behind that.
You can.
Open source, yes. And who knows what open source is? You guys don't count. He does? Okay, well, there's enough people that don't know it, so I'll try to explain it. So an open source software has the very beautiful aspect of being free, as in you don't have to pay for it. The reason is that you can just build the software yourself. So you just cannot distribute open source software without actually making it possible for people to use it for free. You maybe can use a sheet of paper to say you can't, but in the end, as long as it's open source, everybody can build the software. And this is the interesting part. As you know, programmers write code. They write instructions for computers in languages that look a little bit like English and usually consist of a lot of if and thens, right? So they basically have trees of if this happens to this, if this happens to this, and that's a long program that a programmer can read, and if the programmer understands the program, he knows what the computer that executes the program is going to do. However, even though we have tried our best, computers cannot really read programs, so they do not read the instructions, but we have to convert these instructions into zeros and ones that cause crazy things to happen in the processor. And if you have the program only and not the source code, you have very limited means to find out what the program does and does not do. So a program that you're using may have a lot of functionalities that you like, but it may also have a couple of functionalities that you don't know about, just because you can't know about it. You're executing the program on your computer, say a Microsoft Office application, and it does a lot of things that you see, but for example, it also does a lot of things in the background, like connecting to Microsoft servers, trying to download updates, things you don't know. And it may also very well just do something behind your back that you really don't want it to do. So if you really want to trust our software, it has to be open source software. Did that make sense? I don't know, I've been trying to explain this for quite a while, and I think I always fear that I fail. So sorry, there's a question over there first.
I did have a question, like if it's open source then you can say, okay, it's great that everyone is checking it, so it's safe. But that means that there's also no boundaries for people that want to do bad things to get into it and change it. So what about that then? Because that makes me not want to use that.
That's a very good question. So The question is, if so the idea of open source software is that anybody could theoretically check what it does, and that there is this myth of there being a lot of people that would actually do that. Why there's also a lot of people that could just contribute bad things to the open source software without anybody noticing it. So the question is, how would it be a warrant for security that a software is just open source? And the honest answer to this is, it is not. Open source software is just as insecure as closed source software. And we find a lot of bugs in open source software. But at least we have the theoretical possibility to check the software. Whereas in closed source commercial software, we just cannot. It's just impossible to trust it. It's impossible to verify it. But it is a strong problem in the open source software community that this verification and checking process does not happen as often as one would hope this to happen.
Especially if you consider who, as you said, it's standing on the shoulders of giants. So considering who is using open source software, so as we have experienced with SHL, the certificate fail, Heartbleed, it's surprising that there's not more money, effort, and resources put in the auditing and monitoring of the software.
But as I said, so the thing is just a matter of principle. If it's not open source, there's no reason to, there's no way to verify it. If it's open source, there is at least a means to verify it. And in most security softwares, there's a lot of people that actually do care. So let alone a couple of fails in OpenSSL that we've heard about lately, in principle, people are doing their best to actually verify the security of this code. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that any closed source software is definitely insecure, right? It's just a matter of principle. Oh, okay, sorry. I thought I was done. All right, so
not yet.
I want to show you a little piece of open source software that I'm personally using to secure some of my communication. And I'm an iPhone user, and the app that I'm using as an open source app is called Signal. So Signal enables me to have encrypted voice calls, which is very convenient, and encrypted messages, which is also very convenient. So it was developed by the team around Moxie Marlinspike, who has a very good reputation in the open source and security community, but I have to admit that I have not personally tested or verified it. So while I encourage you to use it for just the fun of it, I might not really ask you to use it for your criminal activities or overthrowing the government, right? But just to piss surveillance people off, this is a very good choice to put on your phone. As I think it's free to get, it's easy to use, and it's just fun.
Exactly. Pissing people off can be quite a political action. So I strongly encourage the other people that don't have an iPhone, like I don't have an iPhone, I have an Android phone for ethical reasons and financial reasons, and I use two different applications. One of them is RedPhone. It's for secure talking on the phone. It goes via IP and it's encrypted. So this you would use for maybe planning actions, for example. And the other one that I use is TextSecure. This is for securing your text messages. So both of this is combined in Signal. In Android, it's split, but it's been there before iPhone used it.
The background is TextSecure was developed first. That's why we introduced it last. After that, the team developed RedPhone, and then finally they made their move to the iPhone platform and called the whole thing Signal, and it's combined. So there's actually three apps that are interoperable in principle.
And the next one, little disclaimer, it's not open source, but I'd still like to introduce it because I think Threema, just some of you have Threema already, some people use it. And I think it's great because it's a very good example for user-friendly appearance, because I don't have WhatsApp. I never installed it because I think it's like the box of Pandora. If you install it, a lot of people can contact you suddenly. But I think it looks just like WhatsApp and it's just as easy to use. So my entire family uses Threema already for our family chat. And it even has a very nice and easy way to verify other people with a QR code. And it's always surprising to me when those things just work. But they do. You just hold your phone on the other phone and you can verify each other. So I think one other thing we can't really elaborate on is that this entire security thing is also often based on trust. So and who not to trust, and Threema has implemented that you can verify other users. And I'd strongly suggest you to just install it because it's super easy to use. Although it's not open source. Yeah, and one last thing that you definitely should have heard of is GPG.
GPG is the free and open source implementation of the PGP protocol that you can use for, or the PGP encryption standard that you can use for your emails. And what we have only briefly touched at the moment in this talk, they're coming. What we've only briefly touched in this talk is you actually need to verify the identity of the other party, right? So if I'm sending a message around the world to a friend of mine or a fellow, a partner in conspiracy, I need to make sure that I'm using the encryption key that he has and only he has, so that only he can read the message. And what Threema does much better than PGP is enabling you to verify each other's identity. And I think what in the past we as a security community messed up is that we asked people to use, you know, the one and only system that doesn't trust anyone, that is secure, and you need to verify long fingerprints, and we need to do hour long crypto parties to explain this thing to people. And I'm not so sure that this is something we should actually still claim as being the way ahead, because we've been advertising PGP for 20 something years now, and the actual user base is really ridiculously small. So once you've started thinking about using Threema, Signal, Redphone, or whatever, and you're getting the idea that this is fun, and you try, you know, you actually learn that it's easy to do security and it can be fun, and then you eventually think you want to throw over the government, then you may want to move to PGP, because that's a bit more complicated, a bit more well hung, but and not in the scope of this topic, because we just want to get you started. So if you want to go on with this whole thing, I hope that we have showed you a few first steps, given you some knowledge of the main pitfalls that people can fall into, and encourage you to get together, try these tools, and think about how you can throw over the government in an encrypted way.
Yeah. Just one last notion that I've learned from working with a lot of different people and getting them hooked on encryption is do this together as a group, because communication, as I said, makes much more sense when you have other people using it. And otherwise, if you learn encryption in PGP and try to encourage and just try everybody to tell everybody about it, they might just leave the room and be totally annoyed, but they won't if you do this together. So if you go to a crypto party, take your friends and exchange your keys, learn how to use encryption together and use it as a default. And exactly, never give up. It might be challenging in the beginning as it's every other task that you're dealing with and that's new to you. You're not, we are fairly smart, but we are okay smart, but we are not super smart, or I'm not, but I still could manage to do it, and you can do too. And in case you're doubting yourself, never stop asking. We have to do this all the time as well. And there are so many answers to this, and we have an infrastructure that is explaining you this, and most people are very willing to explain. And yeah, just follow the instructions and make your friends use encryption too. Thank you. Thanks a lot for being here and listening.
How about using sentences for passwords? Because I think they're often a lot more easier to remember. For example, I just say, I like this red fusion lamp, and I write every word with a big character. Is this good?
Yeah, I mean, this is also a good idea, but of course, in the end, it's words after words. And in the ideal case, you wouldn't have to memorize any of your passwords, because it does get more complicated as soon as you have several accounts. And then it's just not one sentence that you have to memorize. Of course, it's better than just one word. But ideally you would have a different password for each account.
So yeah, I mean, if you use a different password for each account and you have a lot of favorites, you know, for example, song lines or sentences that you want to use, just make sure they're long enough, because by just taking sentences, and I think you're talking about just the first letters of each word to combine the password, or are you actually thinking about, you want to write out sentences? Okay, the problem you will have with this is that if you really think about entropy, you're decreasing entropy, because you're making the characters as a... you're giving the characters relations to each other inside your password. So if you say, well, my password is a 10-character sentence, I have a very limited number of words that I would need to fit into a 10-character sentence. And that would enable me again to brute force and guess your password. So a better way is to just take your sentence and take the first letters of the sentence, so, or of a song line, for example. So this again gives you a bit of better entropy, because you have quasi-random letters and the password itself is not prone to a dictionary attack. There are some limitations to it, because If you just use the German language, for example, the first letters of words, there are some letters that are more often at the beginning of a word than others. So if you want to go with like the paranoid idea, you just have a randomness generator generate your passwords. But if you just want to have a convenient way to remember fairly complicated passwords, I think it's a good idea to use long sentences. Just make sure you have sentences with special characters and numbers.
Okay, we have some more questions over here.
Hi. You showed the graphic with the time needed by to brute force. My question is, how does the time needed to brute force depend on the power of the system, or on the power of the hacker system?
Of the cracking system? It does depend a lot. It does depend a lot. But the interesting thing about exponential mathematics is, while the power of the system matters a lot in the lower range, once we're getting up the exponential curve, it doesn't really make that much of a difference anymore how powerful the computer is that you're using for cracking. So if you get into the range of, you know, 10, 15, 20 digits, there's no such thing as significantly reducing the time you need to crack by using a more powerful computer. Eventually you get to the point where it's just plain impossible, or at least too expensive and too much of an effort. So in the lower range, it definitely makes a small difference, right? But in the end, if you really get into the point of exponential powers, it doesn't really make a difference anymore.
And I think, just for the relation, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this curve has been produced with a single computer by the guy who wrote the article that published the statistics. So this is the power of one computer, I think.
I must admit that I don't know where on the internet exactly I stole this.
Thanks for the talk first. And I was quite surprised that you were very strongly advertising Threema, but it wasn't the first time that I heard it. Like, there are a lot of people who recommend it, in spite of Text Secure being very easy to set up as well. And I'm not quite sure. My guess would be that it's just already a lot of people using it, and at least you get that. But yeah, maybe have an answer for me, because I've been asking myself, why do a lot of people recommend Threema?
So for, as a security community, for, as I said, for a couple of decades, 2 decades now, we have been advertising this like truly secure PGP. You have to verify the whole fingerprint, and it's a very complicated thing. And once you've learned all that, you still don't understand it, and then there's nobody you can communicate with. So look where this has taken us, right? If you're actually planning to overthrow the government, make sure you're using the adequate tools, and Threema certainly is not one that you should rely on. But today's society, we're facing different problems. We're facing the problem that the alternative is a means of communication that is totally unencrypted and totally centralized, which is what people are doing with WhatsApp, despite some of WhatsApp's communication now being encrypted as well, but let's leave that aside. So we have these mass communication tools that are totally, completely unencrypted and that the whole world is using. And for decades, we've been trying to pull them away from there by introducing them to totally unpractical and complicated solutions. And Threema just went ahead and said, okay, here's encryption. You need to verify identities. We're going to make it damn easy for you to do that. And you just use this as a start. So maybe we can't trust Threema, but just from their learning approach and the user experience, I think it's a very nice tool to give people a start.
Exactly, and I think this particular start for people in the very beginning is quite decisive, because it seems to me that the identification as a person who is using at least one security tool is super important in encouraging them, because I'm actually quite serious about this problem of people thinking they can't deal with those things, because this is something that I'm facing as the biggest challenge, and that also other people are facing as the biggest challenge, and people just don't believe it's important for them, and also they can't do it. So that's why I think that Threema can at least do a first start to then afterwards maybe using other tools and getting deeper into the topic at least as a start.
One last question, if I can.
Hello. One question for the password manager. How can I combine this with different devices maybe I'm using? Because as far as I understand it, I would have to install it on every device, or I could not enter, for example, Gmail from my work. How does this work?
I have this database. I have it stored online. So, for example, in this scenario, I lose my computer, or I go to another computer, I can download this database, and it's okay because it's encrypted, and I have this master password on my mind, and also have it secured in another space. So, yes, it does come with the cost that it's not super easy anymore to go on everybody's computer, but maybe being in a foreign country, going to an internet cafe, you shouldn't register on super sensitive websites anyways. But actually, for my everyday experience, this hasn't been so much of a problem. There are some websites where I know I must be able to always access them, even if everything goes down, my entire security infrastructure. But I do have those passwords in mind, but those are just maybe 2 or 3 passwords for my database, my email account, and another platform.